any morrow. The Biden administration can remove the biggest contributing factor with the stroke of a pen. They should do so immediately before it is too late.
Hearty congratulations to all our listeners on the 43rd 10-day dawn celebrations marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo choo ka choo. It's the Youth Station for you.
Yeah, that's very true.
It grows.
That's
on
the
you.
Sound of Youth Station.
Exactly. Like at the beginning, you don't like it. You're like, what is this?
The motto of Youth Station.
I'm Muzaffar Haider.
Yes, and I'm Asma.
Sister. So I stumbled across this new word.
Yes.
It's, I like discovering new words, especially if they sound like this. Driblisa.
Yeah, it's so it sounds so archaic.
Yeah, it's like driblisa. What is driblisa? It's apparently an English word.
Yes, of course it is. Mm. It is perhaps the addition of two words, dream and bliss. Like a bliss that happens only in your dreams, in your imagination.
So they took out the M, dream.
Yes, bliss. In order to make it phonetically easier.
Uh-huh, okay.
So it is Dreamblisa, but it is Dimlisa.
Dreamblisa. Okay.
Yes, Dreamblisa. Yeah. So, yes, sometimes we have some imaginations about some people, but those imaginations are not totally true. We should never think of any human being as a perfect creation.
Oh, you can say that.
There's
again.
No masterpiece.
Oh, my God. That. If you... No, never do that. Never think of somebody as perfect. Unless it's the
Prophet. It happens to all of us. We put people on the pedestal, but suddenly, very suddenly, our entire trust is broken.
Yeah.
And we come up like, oh my God, I shouldn't have trusted those people. Mm. And in the end, you're going to turn into a person who is scared of trusting other people or situations perhaps, or getting into new relationships, or
and sometimes you don't only damage yourself, you can damage that person that you have that perception about as well, because they don't even realize that you have that perception of them.
Yes, of
and,
course.
And you're thinking of them as some sort of angel, and they're like, well, why are you expecting all that?
They turn out to be the other way.
Yeah, sometimes.
So perfection is the thing that does not exist in this world. I told you, there is no masterpiece. When I'm in a relationship, I should notice the very fact that my friend is a human being, that a person I'm longing to have a relationship with is a breathing being. So he is not the... you know the story of Pygmalion we have in literature?
No.
There was a person who was a sculptorist. He made sculptures. So he created a sculpture It is in mythology, and then Bernard Shaw wrote a play out of it.
Okay.
The sculpture is made in sculpture, and he loved that sculpture so much in a way that he cried before that sculpture, and he longed for that sculpture to turn into a human being.
Uh-huh.
And then when that sculpture turned into a human being, it was not exactly the same way as he wished for it. So the story of Pygmalion was something like that. You have something in your imagination about somebody, but that thing turns out to be a different thing.
Uh-huh.
The flower you are watering and in the hope of one day turning out into a tree of delicious fruits, you turn out to suddenly understand that that plant is not fruiting at all, is not making fruits at all. So we should never have such idealistic ideas on people, because we might turn out to be the one who loses their trust on humanity.
And of course this applies to a greater extent, I'd say, to the representatives of the religion, especially to scholars, you know, because they, you know, speaking for myself and for other scholars out there, when you're wearing the clothing of the prophet, it's going to reflect.
You're the symbol of religion.
You become a symbol of the religion, and it's a huge and almost devastating responsibility, to the extent that if you commit a small mistake, it can you know, have completely devastating
people
consequences.
People around you have a magnifier in their hands, and they're watching you in a zoomed-up picture, so you have to be so perfect. You are not going to be, because you are a human being, and many things can happen in the lifetime of a human being.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
I looked up the word Driblisa, and it came up with having happiness, or like liking someone because of a good dream that you've had about them.
Yes. Yes, it is. No, but imagination, yes. The story of Pygmalion has many times happened to me. I say, okay, this photo that I have created of that person is so true and so perfect and so colorful. But when I go deep down, I see the devil coming out to me. So I just hold back and say, I should not give people my trust so easily.
It's all about expectations. And sometimes it's expectations that we have of ourselves as well, right?
I mean, yes.
Sometimes you admire somebody else. Sometimes it's even worse. You admire yourself because of the image that you've created of yourself in your head.
Yes, in some situations you come to know yourself that you're not what you thought you are. And those situations are very, sometimes very strange, because it becomes like a weird, you become like a weird picture in front of yourself. You do not know yourself. And those situations are very difficult to bear.
As time passes, you start to know yourself more and more. Yeah, you do realize at one point that you never knew yourself at all.
You know, the new generation, as we are all youngsters, the new generation usually do that. I mean, if they have a friend, if they have a professor, if they have, I don't know, somebody at work, they look at them like they are some perfect human beings. But the consequence of that expectation, as you said, is very horrible, because sometimes you're not just losing your trust, but you become such a timid person, you won't get to trust people anymore. You would turn into a lonesome person. You won't get to.
I remember in my time of innocence when we were kids in school, and the teacher would say one swear word, not even a bad swear word, you know, just like "damn it" or something, and something slightly worse than that, and you'd be like, "Oh." How can you do that?
Yes.
And then you don't
she
realize that.
She uses those words too.
Yeah. You're like, what? But you can't. You're a teacher. How can you do that? Then when you grow up, you realize that, oh, okay.
So that's the way of life. Well, human beings have two parts. I think like the moon. Half of the moon we see it, the other half of the moon is invisible to us.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The dark side of the moon is actually never facing the Earth.
Yes, and we never see that part.
Yeah, we've never seen it.
Yes, we've never seen it.
What if it turns around one day and we see something terrifying?
That's going to be so scary. Just imagine that in the sky, something turns out to be so horrible.
Yeah. But it could be something beautiful as well, you know, it could be.
Maybe.
Yeah. Have you ever experienced that sometimes your relationship with somebody is really good, like you've got a really good friend and you're talking to them, they're happy, you're happy. The next day,
yes.
For apparently no reason.
They show you the reverse.
They're just like turned off from you. They just don't like you anymore. Or you just feel this kind of weird distance. Like,
I mean, it's been a long life, so yes, it has happened.
Yeah.
Even if I don't remember, but I remember the feeling that I had.
Don't you feel like they might have had a bad dream about you?
Maybe it happens to some people.
But you don't remember most of your dreams.
Nothing is impossible.
You don't remember most of your dreams.
Yes, we don't remember.
Because whenever you're sleeping, you are dreaming. Your brain just doesn't stop moving and taking you different places. The point is you just don't remember it when you wake up.
Yes.
And even though you don't remember what happened, the subconscious memories stay with you. So if you've had certain bad dreams about somebody, then in the day, you're going to treat them a little bit differently. And if you've had good dreams about somebody, you're going to treat them differently as well. You're going to be happier around them.
Yes.
You're going to be.
We could also take that as a metaphor, you know, if we consider dreaming and that imagination and expectations that we have of people. We could put it this way, that just like the dreams, when we wake up, we sometimes don't remember anything, or we don't just put so much credits on those dreams. In real life also, about our imaginations, we don't have to give them so much of credits. We have to take them so moderately. I mean, even if we think that somebody is very good, we should put some space for them, that they are human beings and they might go exactly the other way of what we have thought of them. True?
Yeah, I don't like that feeling. It makes things really unpredictable and...
You have to be all the time suspecting things.
And the Quran says, you know, avoid most of suspicion.
Yes.
Sometimes suspicion can even be, you know, ithm, it can even be a sin. Do you ever feel like you're living two lives? Because you wake up and you don't remember your dreams.
A double life.
Yeah, you really are living a double life, because when you wake up, you don't remember your dreams. Then when you go to sleep, you don't remember what you were doing in the day.
Yes.
You have an entire life that you're living.
No, it's interesting.
During your sleep.
I think it's interesting.
You have no real memory of what you were doing in your sleep. Where you were going, who you were talking to.
I think the brain goes where it wants to go. So it's not like I don't remember anything. I remember, but I'm not in it. It's my brain. It's my soul, perhaps.
It is your soul at certain points, but even then you don't remember it.
Yes, we don't remember it. Is it bad that we don't remember it?
I think
sometimes
it's
good that we don't remember it.
Why? Do you think terrible things are happening?
Yes, because some dreams are so terrible.
A lot of what's in the subconscious mind is forming your opinions about people and how you interact with people.
Exactly, the subconscious.
And there is so much in the subconscious mind that we just don't have access to. We can't access it. We don't know what's there. It is so dark and deep.
And there's something. How could we teach that to our kids? I mean, how shall I teach my younger brother or sister that you should have this idea that people are not perfect? You shouldn't go for too much of idealistic thoughts about people. There's no one who's perfect. If you are religious, be religious for your own credits.
Mm.
Don't let that be invested on a person. Because if that person does something wrong, then your entire creed is going to be crushed. So you're going to be in an abyss. It's going to be very difficult for you. How should we teach the youngsters, the kids? How should we tell them that it's a dangerous world? True, but then don't be too dependent on people, on the images you have of people.
I don't know, because when you say that, I'm thinking of my kids.
So
I wouldn't know how to even start with that with her, because I don't want her to know how terrifying the world is right now.
Has she ever talked to you about such an experience? I mean, she trusted her friend and then...
Well, she had one experience with one other girl who was not very nice to her.
Yes.
You know, and that was really like, it was a new experience for her. She'd never experienced kind of bullying or anything of that nature, right? So it was... It was interesting to see how it affected her, because it was such a new experience. It was very like emotionally taxing for her.
Of course,
you know.
So we take it that from the very early ages of our life, we'll learn that we shouldn't.
Not everybody
make
should
a perfect
be, yeah.
image of other people.
I
your friend,
yes,
your
but then she has other girlfriends that she loves. You know, and she probably admires certain people. I mean, she admires me, right?
That's a problem.
That's really scary. It's like, man, wait till you get a bit older and you realize I'm nothing. I don't know. How you can't. For children, I don't think you can pop that bubble.
It's a very sad feeling when you have an image and that image is broken.
Yeah.
Why do we expect people to be too good?
Because... we are naturally inclined towards hero worship.
Hero worship, that's a good point.
Right?
Yes.
But that's going to have to be a topic for the next time, because we've unfortunately run out of time.
Time flies.
Yeah, it does. So, yeah, we've been discussing about Driblisa.
Yes, Driblisa.
Driblisa, yeah. Driblisa, it's this... basically, your thoughts and your opinions about somebody are shaped because of... imaginations,
yes,
and because
some
of
good imaginations,
things which have
perfect
been deposited
images you have
into
of
your
those
subconscious,
people.
Yeah, and the expectations that you have. We hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the discussion, inshallah. From myself and from Sister Asma, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa fi amanillah.
Yes, fi amanillah.
The transfer of political power is perhaps the most delicate moment in the life of a democracy. It follows an election which the party in power lost and its opponents won. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. It has been written by the paper's editorial board. The piece is titled, "January 6th was a warning. Will lawmakers do anything to protect the 2024 election?" Transfer of political power is perhaps the most delicate moment in the life of a democracy. It follows an election which the party in power lost and its opponents won. Inevitably, feelings are raw, tempers are short, and mistrust can run high, all as control of the nation is changing hands. Because politics is how a self-governing society resolves its differences peacefully, it is essential that the rules of this transfer are as clear as they can be. If they are not, they can be exploited to create confusion and discord. In the extreme, as the world saw on 6th of January 2021, ambiguity on the page opens the door to bloodshed in the streets. exactly what the rules aim to avoid. This is why Republicans and Democrats in Congress are right to train their sights on fixing, at long last, the 135-year-old federal law that sets out the process for tabulating the electoral votes that decide who becomes president, known as the Electoral Count Act. Legal experts have been raising the alarm over the act for years. Its most consequential provision, dealing with Congress's counting of electoral votes, is a virtually impenetrable maze, one scholar wrote in 2019. This was the provision that President Donald Trump, assisted by a posse of partisan lawyers, zeroed in on to encourage arguably unconstitutional behavior by Vice President Mike Pence and members of Congress, potentially criminal behavior by Rudy Giuliani and his dozens of fake electors, and obviously criminal behavior by hundreds of rioters who laid siege to the Capitol. It doesn't matter whether any of these people actually believed the wild claims about how the Electoral Count Act works, if they had heard of it at all. The law's confounding language created the space for a seductive narrative about a stolen election and a legal path to take it back. More than a year later, Donald Trump continues to lie about the law, revealing, in the process, his utter contempt for the most basic democratic principles. Mike Pence did have the right to change the outcome, and they now want to take that right away, Donald Trump said late last month in a statement opposing Electoral Count Act reform. Unfortunately, he didn't exercise that power. He could have overturned the election. No, he could not. Mike Pence acknowledged as much on Friday, 4th of February. I had no right to overturn the election, Mike Pence said. Yet that much should have been crystal clear even before 2020. Since it wasn't, and since Donald Trump shows every indication of planning to run again in 2024, it is imperative that Congress clarifies the law right now, before anyone casts a ballot in that election, and before knowing which party will be in charge of the Senate or the House of Representatives. It's not hyperbole to say that American democracy is at stake here. To understand the mess of the Electoral Count Act requires a brief history lesson. The law arose out of one of the most controversial elections in American history, the 1876 presidential election, a nail-biter with disputes over electoral votes in several states, leading to an ad hoc congressional commission that haggled for months and did not settle on a clear winner until just days before the inauguration. Rutherford B. Hayes, who in the end was awarded the presidency over the Democrat Samuel Tilden, wrote that radical change was needed immediately to prevent a similar battle from tearing the nation apart. Still, a decade went by before Congress took any action, and the law it ultimately passed confused more than it clarified. Today, three reforms matter above all: clearly defining the role and powers of the Vice President, of Congress, and the states in electing the President. All three are central to achieving the fundamental goal, which is to ensure that voters, and not partisan political officials, get to choose their leader. Well, let's take each of those players in turn. First, the Vice President. Contrary to the self-serving fantasies of Donald Trump and the lawyers who schemed with him, like John Eastman, the Vice President's role on 6th of January is a straightforward one. Starting at 1 p.m., the job is to open the envelopes and announce the electoral vote counts from each state in alphabetical order, then call for any objections. And that's it. she or he has no authority to unilaterally reject electors from the states. The law already lays out this process, but its outdated language is vague and should be clarified in a way that leaves no room for mischief. Next, Congress. The national legislature has many responsibilities, but sitting as a presidential recount board is not one of them. Whenever a state submits a single, uncontested slate of electors, as all 50 states did in the 2020 presidential election, Congress's job is to accept it. The problem is that the Electoral Count Act makes it easy to throw a wrench in the works by allowing objections to a state submission if only a single senator or a single representative signs on. This sets off hours of debate and delay, a recipe for chaos, as Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley demonstrated with their grandstanding around baseless allegations about voting irregularities that had been rejected by every court that had considered them. To avoid a repeat of this shameful and reckless behavior, Congress should raise the bar significantly by requiring the assent of one quarter or even one third of both houses to lodge an objection, and a supermajority to sustain one. It should also strictly limit the grounds for raising an objection in the first place. But what if a state submits two conflicting slates of electors? And what if the two houses of Congress disagree over which slate is valid? That's a different sort of problem, and while it didn't happen in 2020 presidential election, it did happen in 1876 and could cause a major crisis again in 2024. If, say, a Trump-aligned governor who believes that election was stolen refuses to certify a valid popular vote count that favors the Democratic nominee and instead authorizes his state's Republican electors to cast their ballots for Donald Trump. As the Speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives said last week in rejecting a bill that would have given the legislature the power to overturn the popular vote, "We gave the authority to the people and I'm not going to go back and kick them in the teeth." Yet there is a glaring loophole in the federal law. If a state fails to make a choice by its prescribed method on election day, the legislature may step in and do as it pleases. This provision, even older than the Electoral Count Act, was written to address a narrow set of scenarios specific to the mid-19th century. Today, it only invites abuse, as state legislatures can try to spin any outcome they don't like as a failed election. Congress needs to limit this provision to real failures. A major natural disaster, for example, a terrorist attack or some other catastrophe, and even then, only if it is impossible to arrange for a popular election afterward. Electoral Count Act reform is not the voting issue Democrats were hoping to push through Congress. They are rightly furious with Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, along with every Senate Republican, for thwarting two badly needed bills that would have attacked many forms of voter suppression and partisan gerrymandering. Still, the current push to reform the Act, whose proponents include Senators Angus King, Amy Klobuchar, Susan Collins, and Mitt Romney, is worth the effort, not only because it will help protect the integrity of the presidential election, but because it may well be the only reform with enough bipartisan support to pass in this polarized moment. If its essential components do pass, Democrats can take comfort in knowing that politicians and lawmakers will have a much harder time undermining a valid vote. Republicans who like to talk about the importance of states' rights in our federalist system can be reassured that Congress will stay in its lane and leave the power to appoint electors with the states where it belongs. None of this would be an issue, of course, if the United States simply counted up all the votes and saw who won. In 2020, over 7 million more Americans chose Joe Biden than chose Donald Trump a resounding victory that would have been impervious to all the legally dubious shenanigans that Donald Trump and his allies tried to pull. Even in the closest election of the last half century, in 2000, the national popular vote margin was more than 500,000, far more than the margins of victory in all the disputed states of 2000 and 2020 combined. But as long as we have the Electoral College, the process needs to be as clear and as foolproof as possible. Making it so will not guarantee that things run perfectly. After all, a political movement that is categorically unwilling to accept electoral defeat can do a lot of damage. But just because we can't plan for everything is not an excuse to do nothing. When you make the perfect the enemy of the good, you get neither.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam Khomeini and avoiding extravagance. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of avoiding extravagance in the life of Imam Khomeini. We know that in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has emphasized on avoiding extravagance because extravagance is one of the sins. And when we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to avoid such a thing which is known as sin. And if we do not avoid it, obviously it will affect our life, it will affect our soul, and we cannot apply the pure Islamic lifestyle in our life, and we cannot follow the teachings of Islam. Therefore, it is said that once Imam Khomeini, one of his servants at the house, he said that there was a lamp which used to be, there was a bulb or lamp which used to be on even at the daytime because it was in the courtyard. And Imam Khomeini, whenever he used to come to the whole courtyard, he used to see that lamp. If he could switch it off by himself, he used to do it. And if he couldn't, he used to call me because it was my duty. And he said me for 2 to 3 times that to be careful about this light so that I am not wasting anything. So we need to be considering even not wasting the energy. Therefore, he said that for the 4th time when I forgot to do it and I was living my, like I had my, this was my habit to not to pay attention towards the lamps in the courtyard, Imam strictly has stopped me. And he strictly has said to me that if you cannot pay attention to this single light, then obviously you should not work here because you're not paying attention to the very basic thing that this light which is turned on even at the daytime, it is causing extravagance and this is a sin. So you should be careful, and if you cannot take care of this, then it is not the place where you can work.
Congratulations to all Muslims across the world on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Listen to our special programs on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the avoiding extravagance in the life of Imam Khomeini. Mrs. Hadici says that once in the France, when I was taking care of Imam Khomeini, I went out for shopping and I saw that on that day, because of the cold weather, the oranges are inexpensive. And I bought a lot of oranges, which was enough for 3 to 4 days. And when I came to the house, I saw that Imam Khomeini has noticed that I bought a lot of oranges. And he asked me, why did you bought this much of oranges? We don't need it. It's more than what we need. I just said to him that it's a cold weather and it is enough for our 3 to 4 days. And it was inexpensive. Imam Khomeini said to me that you need to go back and give these oranges back to the shop owner. And we don't need this much. We need only the amount which we use today, and or maybe for 1 day. And he said that by this action which you have performed two sins. Number one is that we do not need this much of oranges. And if you are bringing more oranges, which is extra than we need, it is extravagance. And this is a sin. Number two, there might be some people in this area, in this town, who cannot buy oranges in the ordinary days. And it was the only time, because the oranges are inexpensive, they can buy them. And because you have bought something which is more than what you need, now they cannot do it. Therefore, you must take it back and give it back to the seller. She said it is not possible to do that. Then Imam Khomeini said, then you need to peel these oranges and give to those who never had oranges in their life, or who couldn't eat oranges in the ordinary days. And this is the way maybe Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala forgive our sins that we have committed in this way. Therefore, we need to be very much careful in our life that we must avoid the extravagance as Imam Khomeini has done. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allah, Allah.
إن الذين قالوا ربنا الله ثم استقاموا تتنزل عليهم الملائكة.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
The next point, which in my opinion is very important, is the issue of preserving unity in the country. We must reduce the factors that create discord as much as we can. Of course, there are differences in opinion, viewpoints, methods, and mentalities. These things exist. But we should not let them lead to taking stances against one another. The people's solidarity should not be destroyed by these things. We should not allow these differences to become exacerbated. Of course, there are naturally some individuals who stand up against the revolution, and the revolution has no choice but to stand up against them. But if the issue is about differences of opinion and differences in taste, and if these differences exist in society, they should not cause national solidarity to be destroyed. In other words, the collective decision to defend the country, to help the country progress, and to inspire hope in the youth of the country should remain firmly in place. We should know that there are always some people in the enemy's camp whose expertise is creating discord. They have an expertise in creating discord in order to rule, divide and rule. This is an old policy which originates from these individuals. They know how to do this. We see that they have done this wherever they could. One such policy is creating religious discord, for instance, between Shia and Sunni. We should not allow these things to happen or to become exacerbated in the country.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, Shia and Sunni people have been living together for centuries. They have been living together without any problems for many years. Of course, there have been some differences between some ethnic groups. There have been some issues between various ethnic groups, but there have not been any problems or conflicts between the Shia and the Sunni. Now, if some individuals find an excuse to create such discord, of course, such a thing has not happened so far, but we should not let it happen and we must be vigilant. For instance, if someone makes a wrong comment and someone else responds to them out of their sense of responsibility, this should not be dragged out and continued. Therefore, everyone should preserve this state of solidarity. Pay attention to this fact, that the Islamic Republic is an Islamic government and its flag is the flag of Shiaism. But even in the Islamic countries where Sunnis are living, sometimes people express their interest in the Islamic Republic. They express their interest, advocacy, cooperation and support. In many countries from East Asia to West Africa, there are those who look at the Islamic Republic in this way, but they are not Shia.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's attempts to rally his dilapidated top team floundered on Friday after a second cabinet minister distanced himself from the prime minister and two more conservative MPs called for him to go. The article you're about to hear had been written by the Guardian journalists Heather Stewart and Rowena Mason. The piece is titled Johnson Struggles to Rally Team as Pressure on Him Builds Up. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's attempts to rally his dilapidated top team floundered on Friday after a second cabinet minister distanced himself from the Prime Minister and two more Conservative MPs called for him to go. In a bid to shore up support, Boris Johnson wrote to MPs promising them a direct line to Downing Street. But his move came as Sajid Javid followed the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, in rejecting Johnson's remarks linking Keir Starmer with the failure to prosecute paedophile Jimmy Savile. The Health Secretary said Keir Starmer had done a good job as Director of Public Prosecutions and that he should be respected for it. Sajid Javid said he was glad Johnson had clarified his remarks, though the Prime Minister has not apologized. Rishi Sunak said of Johnson's comments on Thursday, "I wouldn't have said it. The attempt to smear Starmer led to the departure of Johnson's long-standing policy chief, Munira Mirza, on Thursday. In another sign of Boris Johnson's waning authority, two more MPs confirmed they have submitted letters of no confidence in the Prime Minister. The Newcastle-under-Lyme MP, Aaron Bell, called for Boris Johnson to go first, saying in a statement on Friday afternoon, 4th of February, that the breach of trust that the events in Downing Street represent and the manner in which they have been handled makes his position untenable. The MP was widely believed to have submitted a letter after he challenged the Prime Minister in the House of Commons on Monday. Aaron Bell told MPs he had followed the lockdown rules meticulously, driving 3 hours each way to his grandmother's funeral without hugging his family or stopping for a cup of tea, and asked pointedly, "Does the Prime Minister think I'm a fool?" On Friday evening, he was joined by former Minister Nick Gibb, who wrote in The Telegraph that his constituents were furious about the double standards and that the Prime Minister had been inaccurate in his statements to the House of Commons. Nick Gibb, former minister, said, "The Prime Minister accepted the resignation of Allegra Stratton for joking about a Christmas party that she hadn't attended, but he won't take responsibility for those that he did attend. I'm sorry to say that it is hard to see how it can be the case that the Prime Minister told the truth. To restore trust, we need to change the Prime Minister," Nick Gibb said. If 54 letters are sent to the chair of the Backbench 1922 Committee, Sir Graham Brady, a vote of no confidence will be called, and if Boris Johnson loses it, his premiership will be over. Some senior Conservative MPs believe the total number of letters may be close to 40, though the total is never made public until the threshold of 54 is reached. More are likely to when details emerge of whether Downing Street staff have been fined for breaching lockdown rules. The Metropolitan Police is investigating a dozen parties in Downing Street and Whitehall and has been handed a bundle of evidence, including 300 photographs. One person who has seen some of them said, "It looked like a party to me," adding that they would not be surprised if up to 20 Number 10 staff ended up being given fixed penalty notices. On Friday evening, 4th of February, the Mirror reported that the police have a photograph of Boris Johnson holding a can of beer at his lockdown birthday party in June of 2020. Boris Johnson sought to placate Conservative MPs on Friday with a conciliatory letter detailing plans to include them in future policy-making decisions. He's also planning a policy blitz next week, according to government sources, with announcements expected pretty much every day, including on health and a potential overseas trip for discussions on the crisis in Ukraine. Boris Johnson flew to Ukraine earlier this week, and No. 10 Downing Street subsequently released a publicity video about the trip. This week also saw the publication of a long-awaited Leveling Up white paper and Rishi Sunak's cost of living measures. But Downing Street has struggled to wrench the headlines away from the ongoing chaos at No. 10. Boris Johnson told MPs in his letter, "I understand the deep importance of engaging with colleagues in Parliament and listening to your views, and that is why I want colleagues to have a direct line into No. 10 Downing Street," he wrote. "I promise change, and this is what we will now deliver together." One former cabinet minister said they believe the departure from the Prime Minister's team on Thursday evening, which left him without a Director of Communications, a Principal Private Secretary, or a chief of staff, could hasten Boris Johnson's own exit. "The mass exodus is obviously bad for Boris and may bring forward the decision day," they said. Another former minister said, "I think there are probably a lot of people who are going to be wrestling with their consciences over the weekend." They said the exodus from Downing Street all looks a little bit like panic. Elena Narazansky, a special advisor to the Prime Minister on Women and Equalities, Culture, Media and Sport and Extremism, became the fifth aide to depart No. 10 Downing Street on Friday morning. Boris Johnson's spokesman said new appointments could be made in the coming days. Some MPs say they are awaiting for these before judging whether Johnson has fulfilled the promise that he made to overhaul his top team. One Conservative insider said the situation was very fluid, but that No. 10 would want to make the appointments before the weekend was out. Among those being tipped for a communications job are Simon McGee, a former Foreign Office press head, and the current press secretary, Rosie Bate-Williams. For more strategic roles, insiders suggest David Kenzini, an ally of Lyndon Crosby, and Ross Kemsel, a senior political operator at Conservative campaign headquarters. Lord Frost has already made clear that he will not come back into the fold while the national insurance rise is going ahead, and former aides, Lord Lister and Will Walden, are also thought to be resistant to returning. Another senior figure in communication said he had turned down the job previously and would not go to a sinking ship. Prime Minister Boris Johnson gathered No. 10 staff in the cabinet room for a pep talk on Friday morning, quoting the Lion King to tell them change is good, after five members of his senior team, including Munira Mirza, had quit in the space of less than 24 hours. Johnson's spokesperson said he reflected on the privilege of working in No. 10 in order to deliver for the British people and reiterated his and No. 10's commitment to serving the public by keeping people safe, improving lives, and spreading opportunity.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing
and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU migration pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and